Hello and welcome to the podcast of Vineyard Church here in Maryville, Tennessee. We post our Sunday messages here each week, as well as our conversations episodes, which include interviews, special announcements, and in-depth teaching. You can visit vineyardchurch.us to learn more about us or to access the audio archive. You can also subscribe to this podcast on Spotify, Apple, or Google Podcasts. And now, here's the episode.
Good morning, everybody.
My name is Zach, and I'm one of the pastors here. And you guys have a good fourth? Excellent. Welcome to people online as well. I get to talk to you this morning, part of our psalm series that we've been in. Each of us got to kind of pick the psalm that we wanted to preach on, and I chose my favorite psalm. It's one I have loved for a long, long time. It's Psalm 139, and I get to preach to you about that today, but specifically, I want to focus on the idea of knowledge and relationships and where those two things intersect. And the premise I kind of been working on throughout this, all the prep for this, was the idea that the better you know someone, the deeper relationship you can have with that person, right? In other words, like, the more knowledge you have of them, and I don't mean just, like, wisdom and things that you know about them, the more meaningful that relationship will be, and vice versa. You know, if you have very little knowledge of someone, you likely will not be able to have a very deep and meaningful relationship with that person. We run into these kind of relationships all the time in our everyday life. You know, if such a thing as water coolers exist at work anymore, you know, you run into these people that you see every day at the office. Maybe it's classmates you have at school. Maybe it's people when you're at the grocery store or out shopping or things like that. You run into people, you recognize them, you say hi, you exchange pleasantries. It's all kind of surface stuff, though. I mean, you may know some things about them. You may know, like, when their birthday is, for instance, or you might know that they love Mexican food or their favorite kind of music or whatever it is, but they're sort of superficial things. And as a result, those relationships, while fine and good, are sort of superficial, and that's okay. You know, we wouldn't expect that you would know these people in deep, meaningful ways, not always. On the other hand, if you're married, have children, been in a relationship with a boyfriend or girlfriend for a long time, I would hope that you would have a much deeper level of knowledge than just an acquaintance that you know from the office, right? Or somebody that you just bump into at school. I would hope that that deeper level of knowledge would not only lead to you knowing about that person, but having a more meaningful relationship with that person. Because as our knowledge of a person grows, so does our relationship have the potential to grow. But it's not just you knowing about them. There's also something we have to do on our part. There has to be a willingness for us to want to be known by them, right? It's not just I know about you. It's reciprocal. It's I allow you to know me, the degree to which we are open before them. So that's kind of the premise of where we're working through this psalm today, okay? We know we're not going to have this kind of relationship with everyone, but we want to do it with those people that really matter, with the things in life that really make the difference. And so, like I said, we're looking at Psalm 139, and the psalm starts off the very beginning, the first few verses, starts off by David listing all of these things that God knows about him. But it concludes with a crying out to be known even more by God. And what I want to work on today is the way that we get from listing things to wanting to be known. How do we move from one place to the other to this sort of like just facts and knowledge to a desire? All right, so we're going to do this a little out of order. We're going to do verse 1 in the psalm, and then we're going to do verse 23, and we're going to compare those. So verse 1 says, O Lord, you've searched me and you know me. Lord, you've searched me and you know me, right? Okay, verse 2, or verse 23, I mean, says, search me, O God, and know my heart. You hear the difference between the two. The first one is a matter-of-fact statement, Lord, search me and you've known me. And then the second is a crying out to be known. And it's weird because it almost kind of sounds like God didn't fully know David until he allowed himself to be known. But I don't know if that's true, right? I think God knows us fully, right? It says that God doesn't change. He's the same, and he doesn't change in the way he knows us either. I told this story in the first service, and I'll tell it now. It's one of my favorite stories from all of the time that I've been teaching. I was when I was younger and was teaching a friend of ours, youngest child. And I was over at their house, and I knew this little girl pretty well. I'd been friends with them for a long time, and she wrote me a note. You know how sometimes kids will write their teachers little notes that says like how much they like them or something like that? So she wrote me this little note, and I said, to Mr. Zach, and I thought it was really sweet, and I opened it up, and it said, Dear Mr. Zach, I like you as much as I like you. I thought, you can't argue with that logic. That's solid. That was solid reasoning from a five-year-old. I like you as much as I like you. And I say that because, and I know this sounds like the wrong way to put it, but that's how it works with God. He likes you as much as he likes you and loves you as much as he loves you, and he loved you before you ever even did anything. He doesn't love you more because you do more things. He doesn't love you less because you don't do certain things. He loves you as much as he loves you. Does that make sense? Okay. So, God doesn't change how much he knows David, but something changes. And what changes is not God's knowledge of David. What changes is David's attitude in his heart towards wanting to be known by God. There's a move from an acceptance of God, you searched me and you know me, to God, oh, see me, search me and know me. And what I want to do today is figure out how we get from the one place to the other place, right? And we're going to do it going through the psalm in different sections. And my hope is as we do this, you start to see a little bit of yourselves in this psalm, that you start to see a little bit of how this might be like you're a little like David in this, and you can relate in a certain way. So we're going to break the psalm up into four sections, and the first one we're going to do is verses 1 through 6, okay? When we read this together, it says, Lord, you have searched me and known me. And then he starts to list them. He says, you know when I sit down and when I rise up. You discern my thoughts from afar. You search out my path and my lying down and are acquainted with all my ways. Even before a word is on my tongue, you know it all together. You hem me in, you're behind me, you're before me, you lay your hand up on me. And he concludes by saying, such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is so high, I cannot attain it. Some versions say, I cannot comprehend it, I cannot understand it. This is quite a list of the things that God knows about David, right? And he's not just a list of like, here's the things you like and don't like. It's a list of like, I know when you're sitting and when you're standing and when you go out and when you come back. He's familiar with all of our ways. Even before we say a word, he already knows what we're going to say. And David reads this whole thing, recognizing how well God knows us. And he says, this knowledge is too big for me. What it does, this section here points to an attribute of God called omniscience. We serve a God who is omniscient. Omniscient means all-knowing. And it points not just to the all-knowingness of God, but the all-knowingness of God as it relates to us personally, individually. So, in the spirit of personal knowledge, I'll share a little bit about myself. I don't know how much you all know about me, but before I got into the whole pastor thing, I was in school for music. I was in school for music for a long time. I have a couple of degrees in all of that, and it was always kind of my focus and my desire. specifically in the last couple of times I went to school. By the way, I'm not allowed to go to school anymore, is what I was told by my wife. I am no longer allowed to go to school. So I'm done. But the last time I went to school, the last couple of times, my degrees were in music composition and music theory. Music composition is the writing of the music, and music theory is the analysis of the music. Okay, and they kind of form the two parts of that. I've done a fair bit of both of those things in my life. I want to talk about the composing side for a second. When you start this process of writing a song, I've heard people that write novels and books and movies, or this is screenwriters, same kind of thing. You start off with these little themes, these little ideas, little snippets, motives, we call them in music. And you start to let these kind of work around and gel, and you start to imagine how they could form, how this one could relate to that one, and you start to say, oh, this could go over there, and that builds into this part, and then it would build up to this whole thing, and the thing begins to take shape. We begin little by little to begin forming this thing, and it's a huge process that all comes together in the compilation of one complete whole piece of music. And then you go out and you present it. And when this piece is premiered, in other words, the first time it's heard, the people that hear that full piece, that finished product, they hear all of that stuff, but they don't perceive all the inner workings of it, right? They know the elements of it, they hear the different pieces, but they don't know it the way I know it, right? The way that I, the composer, the creator of that piece of music, knows it. And they can't know it unless I do what? Unless I tell them. Unless I share with them those elements. They can't know all of those things. You know, part of this whole studying music and process is I've done a lot of studies on different composers. If I could have 5 minutes with, say, Beethoven, I could spend 5 minutes asking him what he was thinking about this one specific piece, it would replace hours of analysis. Why? Well, it's why it's called music theory, right? It's what I think he was thinking. That's how it works. If it's not what I know he was thinking, why? Because I don't know, but guess who does? Him. He knows it. The creator always knows the depth of his creation. And so what we're looking at in this psalm is a picture of our God as our creator that knows not just what he sees on the surface, not just that, like that piece of music that you're hearing, but he knows all the inner workings. He knows how everything moves and ties together and knits together and all of those things. In Psalm 8, David writing again, and I think it's from that same place, he says, when I think about the heavens, when I think about all what your fingers have created, I think about the moon and the stars that you've set in place, I think, whoa, who are we that you care about us? Who are we that you think about us, the Son of Man, that you care for him? See, what happens is there's the God who knows the organization, the structure, the movements of the heavens, way more complex than anything I can even imagine, not only knows all of those things, is in control of all those things, he also knows me. And he knows you. And he knows us by our name. And he knows us in a way that sometimes we don't even know ourselves. Because he knows at the heart. He knows how he knit us together. And David's response to this is one of just awesome wonder. And he just steps back in verse 6 and says, such knowledge is too awesome, too wonderful to me. It's too much for me to obtain or to understand. So in this first part, David begins to recognize God's omniscience, his all-knowing. Let's look at our second section. So it's going to be verses 7 to 12. We'll read those together too. It says, where can I go from your spirit? Where shall I flee from your presence? If I go up to the heavens, you're there. If I make my bed in Sheol, which is like the depths of the earth, you're there. If I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, Even there your hand would lead me, your right hand would hold me. If I said, surely the darkness will cover me, and the light will be like night around me, even the darkness is not dark to you. The night is bright as day, for darkness is as light with you. There's a lot of heavy statements in that. A lot to unpack. What David is realizing and speaking to in this is a second attribute of God. God's omnipresence. I don't know if you've heard these words before. Omniscient, omnipresent. In a minute we're going to talk about omnipotence. But it's basically pointing out to the attributes of God that God is all-knowing. God is everywhere. And God is all-powerful. And in his omnipresence, David kind of points to two different themes. One about darkness, and the other about running away or hiding, fleeing. When we look at the word darkness, and we see it a lot in Scripture, we think of darkness and you think, like, if I turned out all the lights and it was dark in here, right? Darkness, it has a couple of different meanings when it gets used in Scripture, and if you think about it in the world as well, it doesn't just mean the absence of light. It also means obscurity, right? Like not really being seen well. There's a picture I have on the screen of a child hiding. I have a few kids, and I remember when my kids were little, you might remember this as well. Kids love to play hide and seek, right? Kids love this, love playing hide and seek. And it is so funny. As they get older, they get a lot better at it. But when they're young, it is hilarious because they have such a weird perception. They just have this different perception than what's actually happening around them. They understand their own reality, but not always the full meaning of that in relation to everything else. And so you see, like, this kid here, right? He's totally hidden in his mind, right? Nobody sees him. Why? Because he can't see them. I covered my face. Why do kids like playing peekaboo? You're gone. Cover the face. Disappeared. They don't exist anymore. And there's this idea that this perception is a little bit skewed. If he can't, you know, if you stand still, he can't see him. When I was a little kid, I used to, my dad was in the army, and I had some of his old camo stuff that I would like to dress up in when I was a kid. And my parents would be out working in the yard, and I'd put on all my camo stuff, and I'd walk out into the yard, and I'd try to be super sneaky. And as soon as they would look my way, I'd freeze. I thought, as long as I stand still, they can't see me. And then I'd start going again, and they'd look, and I'd freeze. I thought, they can't see me. And in my mind, I was invisible. Right? No one could see me. It wasn't until older now we laugh about that and we think, you know, I think, gosh, I was something. You make your own judgments about all that. But in my mind, I thought, no one sees me. I was invisible, right? Because my perception was my reality. We do this even as adults. We do this. We think that perception that I'm in a place, God doesn't see me, I'm in this secret place, I'm in my own, I'm away from all the other people, no one sees me, and it's okay, and I'm okay, and it's all right, I'm going to let people see the part of me that, well, but this part over here, no one sees this part is secret, this part is private, this part is just me away from everybody else, and no one knows. But the reality is, right, what David says in here, the darkness becomes what to God? Light. He said that the darkness won't be dark to you. And there's a couple of ways to look at that. One, that God is not, he's not confused. Where did you go? You don't pull the sheet over your head and he goes, oh, hi, you're gone. I didn't know you were there. That's not how it works. But it's also that God brings light into those places. He brings light into those places of darkness, those places that are covered not to God. He brings light into those places. And I don't want you to feel like this is a place of I can't have privacy. No, it's a place of saying I have a God that wants to know the fullness of who I am. It's done from a place of love. It's one thing to play hide and seek with your kids. You would not want your kid to go hide in a place where they could not be found. Think about how that shifts all of a sudden from we're playing a game to I don't know where they are. That's a whole different kind of hiding. Right? It's done from a heart of love. God loves us so much that he doesn't want to be apart from us. He wants to be where we are. There's another part in that passage that I read that talked about fleeing from God, trying to run away from God, to get away from him. You might remember in the beginning of the Bible, in the book of Genesis, there's a story about Adam and Eve. They sin, they did something that went against what God wanted. And do you remember the first thing they did? They hid. They ran away and they hid. Why? They didn't want God to see them the way they were. They didn't want God to see the fullness of them anymore. Maybe you are in that place. I know I've been in that place where I think I've gone too far in the depths, in a place where I don't want God to see me. I don't want God to know me. Maybe there's no way he can find me here. And I've got news for you. If you think that, it's okay. But it's not true. There's no depth that God is unable to reach. There is no place he can't go. There are no lengths that he won't go to find you. Right? This is the reason Jesus came. Right? He didn't stay up in heaven and say, good luck, I hope you can do good enough to get up to me. He came down to be present with us where we are, to meet us in our current reality, wherever that finds you at this moment. He came to meet you here. He's not waiting for you to do the right thing. He's not waiting for you to look a certain way, act a certain way, get to a certain state in your life. None of that. He came to be present with you in your current reality, in the way that you are. We serve a relentless God, a God who loves us when we are at times unlovable, a God who knows us when sometimes we don't even want to know ourselves, and a God who seeks after us when sometimes we really don't want to be found. We serve a relentless God that pursues us from a place of love. And so God, or David, I should say, is recognizing all of these things, all that God knows. And he moves into this third section that we're going to look at, which is the idea of God's omnipotence, which is God's all power. We talked about it a little bit earlier, but I want to go ahead and read all of this the way it's written here. He says in verse 13, "You formed my inward parts, knitted me together in my mother's womb. I praise you, for I'm fearfully and wonderfully made." Think about the composition I was saying earlier. "Wonderful are your works. My soul knows it well. My frame is not hidden from you when I was being made in secret, intricately woven in the depths of the earth. Your eyes saw my unformed body. In your book were written every one of them, the days formed for me, when as yet none of them had come to be. How precious are your thoughts, O God. How vast is the sum of them. If I could count them, they'd be more than the sand. And I awake, and I'm still with you." There's a couple of parts to this, but the bottom line is that David begins to accept God's role in his life, his authority, his goodness, his power, and his love. Not just as somebody that knows stuff about him, but his role as the creator, the composer of his life. David says he knew me before I was formed. All of these details he goes through. And he recognizes all of these things that God knows and how much he loves him, cared about him, called him by name before he was born. And he just gets to this point that he cries out, "How precious are your thoughts about me, O God? How vast are the sum of them?" And then he uses this wonderful illustration. Were I to count them, they would outnumber the grains of sand. Now, the Bible is filled with hyperbole, all right? These kind of grand examples that are so huge and enormous, they're designed to make you think like, wow, it's a lot. It's a big thing. You know, there's a point when God is making a promise to Abraham about his descendants, and he said, there'll be more than the stars in the sky, and you think, wow, that's so many. But I thought just for today, this idea of grains of sand, maybe we could just do a little reality check with what that is. Because it's one thing to think a lot. It's another to put a number on it. So I brought something with me. I brought a cup filled with sand. This is an 8-ounce cup, one cup filled with playground sand. Take a guess. You know those games you play at the carnival? You know, how many candy corns are in the bucket or whatever? How many grains of sand do you think? Million? Maybe 2 million? 10 million? The first time I ever did this, somebody said 12. Spoiler, it's more than 12. What do you think? 100 million? 200? 300 million? Half a billion? Are you ready? I did the math, because you can measure it by the size of the grains and the amount of space that it takes up. You sure you're ready? 3,614,981,715 grains of sand in that cup. 3 billion. Let's just round it down 600 million and say it's 3 billion grains of sand. That seems like a good round number. And each one of these grains of sand represents what? A thought that God has about me. And about you. I don't know about you. I can't think of anything I've thought about 3 billion times. I mean, and then this, pardon the expression, is like a drop in the bucket. This is a cup. Right? David doesn't put like a qualifier on it. He doesn't say it's the grain of sand in a cup or in a big amount. He doesn't even say on this specific seashore. Right? He doesn't say he just says the grains of sand anywhere, the whole world, all the grains of sand. And he doesn't say that that's how many thoughts God has. He said it exceeds that. It outnumbers that. That's how much our God thinks about us. That's how much our God cares about it. And it just blew me away. I thought it was going to be like maybe half a billion, maybe 500 million grains of sand at the most. 3,614,981,715 thoughts in a cup. How many cups do you think are on one beach? Just imagine, you go to your favorite beach, you take your cup with you, you scoop up one, two, that's 6 billion, three, 9 billion, 12. Do you see? I mean, there's a reason the Bible uses hyperbole for it. But it's not, sometimes we need to put something with it, a concrete thing that we can go, oh my goodness, it's a lot. Right? Can we just agree, like, that's what a lot is? A lot is not, because sometimes we don't put that math in our heads. We don't think about it that way. I love my kids. I love my wife. I have not thought about them 3 billion times. And I did the math on that too. If I did, let's say I thought about them every second, every day, 24 hours a day. Do you know how long it would take me to think 3 billion thoughts one every second, every day, 95 years. This is an entire life's worth of thoughts in this little cup. Remember that part where David says in a different psalm, he said, if I was going to count them, my life would have to be like yours. That's what he means. Guys, God loves you so much. It is beyond our comprehension. At the beginning, David said, this knowledge is too big for me. It's beyond what I can understand. And so through this psalm, David has learned a lot about how much God knows about him. And he is learning a lot about who God is. You see that reciprocal relationship we talked about. And so what was David's response? Search me, O God, and know me. We're not in matter-of-fact knowledge anymore. You've searched me and known me. We're at a place of a heart desire that yearns and desires to be fully known by God. In 1 Corinthians, it says that today we know like in a dim mirror. One day face to face. Now I just know in part, but one day I'm going to know fully, and this is the part I want you to notice, even as I have been, notice the tense of that, not will be, have been fully known. Our desire is to know God. His desire is that we would let ourselves be known by him. He knows about us, but it's to the extent, right, that we are willing to be open, to live a life that is open before him, to say, I want to be in that deeper relationship. I want to draw close to you. I want to go deeper. David's life in these words becomes this open book. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Test me. Know my anxious thoughts. See if there's anything offensive in me. And then lead me into a way everlasting. David's life is just laid bare before God. No pretense. Nothing curated. Here's who I am. We live in a world that is fascinated with curated personalities. Social media, things everywhere, is about people deciding what they want you to see. We look at these people, we get to know these personalities, and we think we know these people. We don't know these people. We know what they want us to know. Right? We're not careful. Sometimes we live that way before God. I say, God, I want you to know this part of me, but I'm not so sure about this part. I love this. This part is great. God, see this, see me. Not over there. Not in this place. And I get it. Like, we do it from a place to protect ourselves. We do it to keep people from knowing the real us. Sometimes we don't even know the real us. And David, he just cries out and he says, I want to show you the real me. I want you to see who I really am. And guys, I have been there and I get it. When you get to the place where you're like, if they only knew, if people only knew the real me. But I've got news, good news. God does know the real you. God created the real you. And he loves the real you. Jesus died for the real you. He came down for the real you. He knows everything about us. He still calls us his friends. He still loves us. He still thinks about us trillions and trillions of times. And it's nothing we can do to change it. That's what grace is all about. The grace of God is love without restraint. Right? It's love and it's mercy given to us by a relentless God because God desired that we would have it. We don't earn it. We can't change it. It's a gift for us. Now, God never, ever forces a relationship. He doesn't coerce. He doesn't mandate. He invites. He waits. And he knocks. Revelation 3:20 said, I stand at the door and knock. And if anybody hears my voice and opens the door, I will come in and eat with him and he with me. Think about that in the context of what we were just talking about. This does not sound forceful. He stands at the door and knocks. Do you have to answer the door? No. But if you do, if you choose, he comes in. And what does it mean, sit down and eat with him? He's going to get to know you. He wants you to get to know him. So we're gonna enter into a time of Selah. And kind of in closing, I just want to say, I don't know where you are this morning. I don't know where you are on this path. And I won't pretend that we're all in the same place and we all need to say the same thing. We all need to say, search me, O God, and know me from time to time. Maybe this is the first time you've recognized how well God really does know you, how much he loves you. Maybe you're realizing God's authority and his power in your life. Maybe you know all these things. And there's an invitation out there. An invitation to be known, loved, and accepted by a God who loves us since before the foundations of the world. So I just want to invite you to think, to imagine, to pray, to cry out, God, search me and